I've had the pleasure of praying with Reverend Lydia Joy Ayers for a while now. I'm probably 9 months or a year, I'm not sure exactly how long, but her enthusiasm and her joy that she expresses in prayer has been uplifting for me listening to her. So when we came around to have another chapter from Anatomy of Healing Prayer, I thought, who do I want to listen to talk about prayer? And I thought, Lydia Joy is always a delight to hear pray. So I want to hear her talk about praying. And so I invited her today and was so grateful that she said yes. And so here is, for the first time at Sterling Study Group, Reverend Lydia Joy.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here. And yeah, like Connie said, we're both part of a ministry of prayer through Celebration Center for Spiritual Living, which is how we met. And I was excited to be invited and excited to say yes to come and speak with you all this morning. So I'm going to start with just a deep breath, because I couldn't use a deep breath. Whew. Right. Speaking alone is always an interesting experience. And then speaking on Zoom, there's so much God happening through technology and so much technology happening, but try to remind myself to just stay centered. So you'll find me taking deep breaths. I won't explain it every time, but that's what I'm doing. All right. So this was a very fascinating book to get to spend some time with. One of the things that I love about the concept of a Science of Mind study group is that y'all really, I think, get to dive into some of the material that centers don't. Centers spend a lot of time on the classes and spend a lot of time on what I feel like calling the greatest hits. You know, the things that work from the pulpit, the things that stay punchy, not for any... Their focus is just different. You know, neither is better or worse than the other, but the study groups, I think, really hold the knowledge and the wisdom and all of the traditions of our teachings. So thank you for that. And thank you for inviting me. It's amazing to get to be here. So this, I don't know about y'all, but I'm gonna just own my vulnerability here for a moment. I was so excited to get this book. I hadn't heard of The Anatomy of Healing Prayer. I was like, great, a new Ernest Holmes book for me to read. I had to read the chapter twice before I felt like I understood what Ernest was getting at here, because I'm sure I'm not the only person in the room to have this experience, but it is dense and there are a lot of ideas. And please understand, I say this with great affection, but Dr. Ernest Holmes never said in 50 words what he could say in 5,000. So we've got a little of that going on, but I'm excited to dive into it. It's a really rich thing to get to talk about in a study group. And I know that y'all spoke about it last week as well. Sorry, my mouth gets very dry when I'm speaking. But where I'd like to begin is just overviewing the chapter a little bit. There's so much going on that I think it's worthwhile before we dive into prayer and treatment itself, and we will spend some time. I will thank you for what you said about my prayers, Connie, but I will certainly spend some time talking about what prayer means to me, because it's my favorite thing to do. but I want to give Ernest a little time here. And one of the things... There are a couple of main points that I got from his chapter that I'm just going to go over briefly. The first being what religious science sort of stands for. And I don't think I had captured it. I've been all the way through ministerial school. I don't think I had captured it in as succinct a way as he put it in this very long chapter, as succinct as we can ask Ernest Holmes to be. But he pointed out two main things: the recognition of the divine presence in each of us, personalized as us, and the universality of the law that works around the whole. And I really appreciated those two those two little clips almost of what we are talking about. I've had the experience lately of, I'll tell you more about this a little later this morning, but I'm, pardon me, I'm doing an internship right now in a hospital as a chaplain. And I'm the only person there with a CSL background. And people ask me a lot of times what our philosophy is or what our religion is. And they want to know more about my faith tradition, which is wonderful and kind of them. And I have found myself, even after so much time in Centers for Spiritual Living, kind of stumbling in the moment of like, well, what is relevant here to say about what CSL is? Because as we all know from having read so much of Ernest Holmes' work, there's a lot that goes into this philosophy. And I've thought a lot about, well, what does that mean in the hospital? What does this mean as a hospital chaplain? And spirit working how spirit does. My third week of this internship, I was invited to speak on a chapter that was pretty much, here's what is relevant to a hospital chaplain in religious science, which is fantastic. So the recognition of the divine presence personalized as each of us and the universality of the law. And I love that Ernest Holmes continuously points out that the universal is intimately personal to that which it personalizes. That's a direct quote from page, it's 207 in my copy of this book. But I just need to sit with that for a minute. Every time I read it, I think there's a real tendency in Centers for Spiritual Living to get very excited about the law. And that's great. The law and the creative process are amazing things. I'm not saying we shouldn't be excited about them. But there is a point when it almost starts to feel like God is a process instead of God is something personal to us. The emphasis, I think, forgive me if I'm stepping on any toes here, but sometimes we can have an emphasis on things like manifesting and things like, you know, change your thinking, change your life. And if we think these things and we pray these things and we're going to create the lives we want, and that's all great. And these are powerful tools that we have from our teaching. And for me, the implication of this divine universal God that is intimately personal to me because it is expressing itself as me is so much bigger than the thought that I can manifest what I want. Like at a certain point, I think the Hindus and the Buddhists sort of do this. At a certain point, I stop wanting things because I'm so enwrapped in my relationship with spirit. And it's not, I'm not saying that wanting things is a bad thing and that we shouldn't want things. We live in a capitalist society. We can't help but want some things. Nobody's bad for that. But the part of our teaching that I want to lean into is less about creating the life that I want and more about remembering the divine presence existing as me, which is a wonderful, beautiful, absolutely powerful part of our teaching. Piggybacking from that a little bit, in this chapter, Dr. Holmes also talked a lot about what he called religious morbidity, which I just need to pause for a moment. What a phrase. Religious morbidity. So good. I love it. But he talked about how we're sort of drugged with this concept of suffering and thinking of suffering as inevitable. And this made me think of the Buddhists as well. And I don't remember, I think maybe it was Judy who said that she recently spent time in a Buddhist temple. Of course, because spirit works that way. I can't wait to hear more about that later. I hope I get to. But something that I learned in a course that I had on Buddhism through the Holmes Institute was that according to most streams of Buddhist thought, there are three kinds of suffering that we humans sort of fall into. The last one being the one that's sort of hardest to tease out, and it's the suffering of suffering, or what my instructor referred to as the suffering of our vulnerability to suffering. We know that we can be sad. We know that we can be harmed, and so we suffer. This is what we're feeling when we're feeling things like, because I have a medical background, anticipatory grief, if you know what that means. You know someone is going to die, so you're already grieving. We know no one in my family, thank goodness, is currently sick or expected to die anytime soon, but I'm aware that my parents eventually will decline and pass away. And the very thought of that is enough to get me crying much of the time. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about the suffering of suffering. It's my vulnerability, the fact that I know that things will happen that hurt. And it also made me think of another little nugget that I have received from Buddhism through the years is the idea that pain and suffering are sometimes equated when they don't have to be. I think the bumper sticker slogan for this, which y'all have probably seen, is pain is inevitable and suffering is optional. Suffering is the idea that this should be some other way, or that something else should be happening. I will never forget. I had a wonderful stepmother for about a decade. She married my father when I was a teenager. Absolutely beautiful, wonderful woman with just the best soul. Eventually became sick and died. And the day before her funeral, my father was sitting with my sisters and I and talking about just what the funeral is going to be like, sort of prepping ourselves for that. And he told us to remember that nothing's wrong here. This is sad and this hurts, but don't let yourself be fooled into thinking that something is wrong here or that this shouldn't have happened. This happens. This is what life is. My father is heavily influenced by Buddhism as well. But that's always stuck with me, the remembering that just because something hurts doesn't mean it shouldn't. And it's okay to feel some pain. To be human is to feel some pain sometimes. Ernest Holmes was talking about this in the concept of the religious, what I understood as the concept of the religious sort of obsession with death and suffering. And I understood that to mean the Christian obsession with death and suffering. I could be wrong. I didn't get the chance to ask him what he was talking about. But that was also really interesting for me to think of this week, because as I mentioned a little earlier, and as I'll get into a little bit later, I'm doing an internship as a hospital chaplain right now. Most hospital chaplains are Christian in one way or another. Most hospital patients that I've encountered so far are Christian in one way or another. We live in a profoundly Christian society. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I don't really have much against Christianity anymore. It used to, when I originally found CSL, I would have said that I did. And I know that a lot of us in Centers for Spiritual Living and a lot of us interested in Science of Mind often came from Christian backgrounds and found our way here because that didn't work. And sometimes that came with pain or with suffering or with real trauma. And I don't want to ignore any of that. But I was speaking to a friend who's also in this chaplaincy program with me and who is Episcopalian. And she is a very wonderful, wonderful, sweet person who carries the love of God around in her heart. You can see it when you speak to her. And we were talking after our first couple of days of going out on the floors in the hospital and visiting patients. And I was still, I'm going to get more into this later. I was still sort of balancing, how do I think I show up as a chaplain? Because I don't want to show up and pretend I'm of a faith tradition that I'm not. I am a Science of Mind minister. I'm not going to pretend that I'm not when I'm in those rooms. But also, a lot of people don't know what that even is. And at someone's bedside in the hospital isn't the time to get into a conversation about it. I'm here to support them, not give them, 5,000 words to think about. And as I was talking to Rebecca about this, my friend, I was saying, really where it's coming up is in prayer. Because the way we pray in CSL is so specific and so distinct from Christian prayer in a lot of ways, and it's really beautiful. And I want to figure out a way to pray with these patients that honors what they need, because I'm here for them, and holds integrity with my own belief and truth, because if I'm standing there saying a prayer that I can't mean, then it's nothing. And Rebecca said something and then told me that she felt she was leaning on Jesus too much when she was in these rooms and praying. And I asked her what she meant by that. Because in my mind, I'm like, so are you just sitting there having a conversation about Jesus? How does that look at the bedside? And I was like, well, what do you mean by you're leaning on Jesus too much? And she said, one of the parts of the story of Jesus that means so much to me and that I keep using in my prayers in the hospital is the thought that God knows what it's like to feel our pain. And I had to pause there, because that is a really beautiful part of the Christian story. That is a really personalizing part of the Christian story. And I think a really helpful part of the Christian story, even as a CSL minister, to use, because some of our ideas are a bit nebulous and thinky. And there's a reason why we teach children morality through fables. Here's almost a fable or a myth that can be used to say the divine presence, the ultimate everything that is, knows what it feels like to feel your pain and knows what it's like to be you. God has been you. God is being you right now. And if that doesn't work for people because they're not familiar with this philosophy, then God has been a human before and God has experienced this. So it's been really fascinating to use those sort of in conjunction with each other and think about what I used to see as a very morbid part of the Christian story and a very dark part of the Christian story. It had never been expressed to me in a way that said, this means God knows what it's like to be here. So it was just wonderful to sit with. I invite you to sit with that through the week and see how it lands for you. And if you don't want to and it doesn't land, great, fine. A final point of Ernest's thinking that I want to go over before we sort of move more into the nitty-gritty of prayer and how I feel about prayer, are his sort of psychological interpretations of what's happening in the human mind, especially when we're hung up on our own suffering or creating suffering where there was only pain. He used a lot of Freud, which was, I will also own that I can be a little bit of a dork. Freud is just a fascinating figure. If you have ever had the opportunity to study history of psychology or any of Freud's work and the large bodies of work that have been created to discredit Freud's very strange ideas, do yourself a favor if you're bored one weekend and go down that rabbit hole, because it really is fascinating. But at the time that Ernest Holmes was writing, Freud was the father of psychology and really considered an authority. The entire psychological structures at the time were based on Freud's thinking. They aren't any longer because some of those ideas were pretty out there. But that's also a fascinating story. And analysis was kind of a popular therapy at the time. For anyone unfamiliar, nowadays, if someone says that they're doing therapy, they're likely not doing analysis. There are very few trained practitioners of like Freudian analysis anymore, partly because it's a very lengthy process and partly because so many further studies have shown that that's not really how the mind works. So, you know, why do this whole thing? But without Freud, we wouldn't have Carl Jung. Or any psychology, but we wouldn't have Carl Jung. And again, study group, you all probably know more about this than I do because you've probably read the back catalogs and all of the archived work that doesn't make its way into the center sometimes. But Carl Jung had a lot of really wonderful ideas that we still use today, especially in CSL. He would refer to things like the universal unconscious and the subjective unconscious. And that also very much influenced Ernest Holmes' ideas of the subjective unconscious and what we still in science of mind believe and teach, that there is, sometimes we call it race thought, sometimes we call it the collective unconscious, all of that idea that anything we're not paying attention to is just sort of around in the collective soup and might come out in some other place in some other way. Are really helpful. Let me look at my notes for a second. Yeah, that was what I was going to say. And as Ernest Holmes sort of spoke about Jung toward the end of this chapter, he pointed out that some people seem to think that Carl Jung had gone too far. And he hadn't so much gone too far as he had gone to a place that not everyone could follow. Because at a certain point is where the mysticism has to come in. And the awareness of a transcendent ultimate spirit comes in that is not always easy for everyone to follow. And in mainstream psychology, especially in the early part of the 1900s, just really couldn't be backed up by science and felt a little off. As a tiny aside, I have been to an Episcopal church a handful of times recently because there aren't any centers around here, so I just sort of bit bop around. Every single time I have gone to this particular Episcopal church in Boone, the minister has mentioned Carl Jung. And it has been such a beautiful experience for me to remember that we're not as different as we think we are sometimes. You've got your story, I've got mine. You've got your words that you like to explain God, I've got mine. But at the end of the day, we still both think Carl Jung was onto something and that we're all swimming in the same divine showing up in different ways, which is just phenomenally beautiful. I can't begin to express how much I love it. I think that's enough of the chapter for now, and we're going to move on into a little bit of what prayer means to Lydia Joy, because that's what Connie asked me to talk about, and I've spent 20 minutes on the book. Sorry, Connie. Toward the end of the chapter, Ernest Holmes talked about getting to a place of non-combativeness and non-opposition, which I think is, I'll admit that when I first read that, I prickled a little bit. I don't think of myself as a combative person. I do think that every now and then we misuse words. Maybe not Ernest Holmes, but I think that every now and then modern ministers and practitioners of religious science misuse some words. And I have seen non-combativeness and non-opposition be used to not stand up against injustices that are happening in our world. And I think in 2023, it's pretty apparent that there are some phenomenal injustices and injustices. That's the right word, not injustice. Injustices going on in our communities. And I don't think that a place of non-combativeness means we have to allow that to happen. I think a place of non-combativeness means that behind it all, we remember that God is trying to express itself and something is happening here that's getting us confused. And that at the end of the day, even I and the person that I might fundamentally disagree with are expressions of the divine trying to make something happen. Doesn't mean I have to understand it, but it means I don't have to hate them as a person. And it also means I don't have to watch them hurt other people. Ernest Holmes also talked about praying for transcendence and getting to that place where God just is. I understood that along with the concept of non-combativeness as once again, just getting into that real universality, the real unity, you know, the first two steps of prayer, the recognition and the unification, getting to a point where I stop remembering that I am praying a prayer and I am only in God. And what I love about prayer is that I can get there when I pray. And it's fantastic and it's beautiful and it's sublime. And I don't have enough words to express what it's like because it's such a sensory, emotional, and mental process of stripping away me and remembering that God is happening. When I was a very little kid, I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. I'm originally from Kentucky. For a lot of reasons, I stopped being part of the Southern Baptist Church when I was a teenager. And like many people who find their way into CSL, I was hurt by the church. I was hurt by the concepts of God. I didn't want to hear those stories anymore. They were ugly and mean and had been used to deny who I am and to say that I wasn't a child of God. I think a lot of people have that experience. I tried to become an atheist because I thought that that was the only other choice. And I couldn't do it. I tried so hard not to believe in God. But one of the things that something I am grateful for about my Southern Baptist upbringing is that there was no question if there is a God. Perhaps that God expresses itself differently than the way that I understand God now. Perhaps it was a different conceptualization of this huge, massive, incomprehensible thing that is God. But there was never any question about it. And I couldn't get myself to a place where I didn't believe in God anymore. So I started telling people that I believed in the Force, for any Star Wars fans in the room. I was like, it's something that moves around us and between us and through us and connects it all. And I don't know what I would call it. Now I just call it God. For a while, I called it the Force. And then from there, I found Buddhism and studied some Buddhism for a while and some Hinduism for a while. I would never have quite called myself a convert, I don't think, but they were inroads to me for a new idea of God. And then I found my way into a Science of Mind community and was immediately at home with the way that we talk about God. Because one of the most beautiful things about our teaching, what I think is one of the most beautiful things about our teaching, is that it's open to any conceptualization, because we fundamentally understand that God is so much bigger than our human minds can put words to. So we conceptualize it in the way that works for us. And if the way that I conceptualize it doesn't work for Connie, Connie is perfectly at liberty to hold her own conceptualization. My very first Foundations of Science of Mind class, or Foundations of Spiritual Living, I don't remember what it's called anymore. We just called it Foundations in my center. My very first Foundations class, I remember the practitioner saying, you can use whatever words you want in prayer that work for you. If you don't like the word God, don't use it. And my mind was blown. Like, what do you mean I can use a different word? Or if you don't think about God the same way that I do, that's fine. You don't have to take the way that I think about God. And this circles us all the way back to the very beginning of what I was talking about when I was kind of going over Ernest Holmes' chapter, that the divine is personalized in each of us. And so the way that we even conceptualize God is personalized in each of us, because God is, of course, all of us. You know, if God is my hands clasped together, each of us are just little fingers branching off, but part of the hand still. But because we're each individual expressions, we each get to see and experience the divine in our own different ways, which I think is wonderful. So prayer. With the last few minutes, we'll just talk about prayer. And as I've mentioned, doing this CPE internship and trying to figure out, how do I pray in a room with someone who has told me that they are Southern Baptist and that they are a Bible-believing Jesus lover? Wonderful things. I'm happy for these people that their faith is there to help them. And how do I pray with this person in a way that I can say and mean, and in a way that speaks to what they need? And what I have found is it's actually not that hard. I was very in my head about it for the first week that I was doing it. I spoke to my CPE instructor. I spoke to my colleagues. Not sure how to do this. Apparently that's part of the learning process, because everyone that I spoke to and said that this was hard said, yeah, you'll have to work through that. And I was like, is this part of the whole thing? And my CP instructor's like, Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much for that non-answer. But I appreciate that, just like CSL, she was letting me find my own truth in my own way. And what has been really helpful for me is to remember a couple of things. One of them being what my friend Rebecca said, that she has in her prayers used the story of Jesus to remind people that God knows what it is to suffer. God knows what it is to be human. God knows what it is to be afraid. And my own tradition and my own CSL style of prayer, which remembers that God is all that is ever happening. And so God is happening right here, right now, in this hospital room, even in the fear, and even in the pain, and even in the discomfort, and even in the uncertainty, because God, we know that God knows what it is to suffer. And sometimes I play with the words a little bit. Sometimes I have to twist them around a little bit. Sometimes I throw in some, you know, in the name of Jesus, and Father God, we know that you are here with us. And then I really move into a treatment. And I didn't know at first how that would go, because I thought people might not think it was a prayer. And so far, no one's complained. And I have found that I'm able to get to that place in that room where I forget that I think I'm separate from the person lying here in this bed, and that I think my spiritual teaching is somehow separate from theirs. and instead get to that place of transcendence and remember that behind all of this, the only thing happening is God. It's God happening right now. And God comes through in the words, and God comes through in the feelings. And I hope that in your prayers, you've experienced this too. And I imagine you have. What I love about our very formulaic method of prayer is that, for one, it has steps to follow, because I love steps. Please give me a list. I love it. It's the best. And two, the first two steps sometimes are almost all that I do in a prayer, especially if I'm praying for myself. Because once I've gotten to the point when I really have recognized that all is happening right now is God expressing itself right here, right now, in this moment, and as me, and I am a piece of that, and the divine is expressing itself right here and right now through me, I usually forget what I wanted to pray about, because it's just not there anymore. It's like the veil lifts, or the part of me that was focusing on what I can manifest stops worrying about what I can manifest and instead remembers who I am. And that doesn't matter anymore. I don't want it anymore. I'm not concerned about what I think I want. I'm just in awe of the way that the divine comes through me, and relaxed and supported, and know that I am at home and safe and loved in the divine, as part of the divine. I think I've spoken enough. That's the best that I can get to about prayer. I think something magical happens that is just beyond words.